Hello, beautiful. And what I'd really like to know is, what is good in your life today? I'm Kia, and this is another episode of the Female Veterans Podcast. And I want to just give a shout out to my sponsor, Runt Style. I am so excited to be sponsored by them because they have really cute merchandise at their website, gruntstyle.com. And you can get 10% off your first order if you use my last name, Baker, at checkout. And I'm proud to be affiliated with them because they're super patriotic. They have cute stuff. And they have an amazing foundation that does work with mental health and homelessness amongst our veteran community. So what's not to love? We should be supporting veteran-owned businesses. And not only are they veteran-owned, they employ, I think, over 200 veterans. So it's important to me. So I'm sharing it with you. And I also want to mention, in case I never have, why I always say that I want to know what's good in your life today. And that's because sometimes we get so caught up in our day-to-day grind that we see so much negativity that we forget what's good and what's good with us. And so that's my way of doing a little assessment for myself and for you to do a little assessment in your own life to really take a look at what is good and focus on the good things and the positive things. And so that's why I say that for anyone who was interested. I'm super excited today because I have a Coastie in the house and I am always looking to interview Coast Guard females. So if you know one, send one my way. Today we have Carolyn Walsh in the house. She is a former Coast Guard officer. She's an author. And she works with an amazing organization to help veterans, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. But first, I want to say welcome, Carolyn.
Hi, Kia. Thank you. Great to be here chatting with you.
I'm so excited to have you here with me today. So let's jump right into it. Tell me, what made you join the military?
I joined the military after I graduated with my bachelor's degree in psychology, and I actually enlisted first with two friends. We graduated in 2009, which is right as the economy in the US just tanked.
Yeah.
And we were kind of like that first generation where the degree was not going to get you the stability that you had, you know, expected from that experience. So my friends, we went to school out in California, and they met a Coast Guard recruiter while they were surfing, and they came back and they told me, we're going to join the Coast Guard. And I was like, that's wild. I don't know anything about the Coast Guard. They're like, you should join too. I was like, let me think about it. So they were all about it right away. And I did my research. I needed to like just analyze what I was doing. But I eventually came to the conclusion that it was going to be a good move for me. You know, I figured I could pick up some skills, gain experience, and kind of let also that economic turmoil, you know, see what was going to happen with that over a couple of years.
Okay, wait. Before we go on. So yeah. You're like finished college and you're out in beautiful California, one of my favorite places in the United States. And your friends come back from surfing and tell you, we're joining the Coast Guard. Join with us.
Yes, this is very much like how it went. And I,
wow.
Yeah. So it was a leap.
I can just imagine the look on your face, like, you're doing what now? And I should do what? What? That's kind of a big decision to like just go out one day and then come back and be like, we're devoting our life to the military for the next, I don't know how many years.
Right. And yeah, just like they were all about it. Like they were just so excited when they came back to me, like, you only have to do 20 years and then you get retirement. Like you can get your GI Bill and your master's degree paid for. So like they were all in on it like very quickly. So I was a little more like standoffish. I like called my parents. I talked to like family. I thought about it like pretty deeply. But then was like, you know what? Like they might be onto something. This could be a good move.
Right on. So how long was it until you went off to boot camp, or you went in as an officer?
I went in enlisted. So I went to boot camp. Yeah. The three of us went to boot camp together. We graduated in May and our boot camp started in June. So we had looked at the officer candidate school and we were like, well, this is a long process. We might not even get picked up the first time, which is, you know, the interviews are going to be months away. And graduating college, like, we wanted something, like, you know, like, so yeah, I went to boot camp pretty quickly after graduating college.
That's really interesting, because I'm thinking back to when I was going in, and I always tell the story about how I had the option to, did I want to go to ROTC or did I want to go enlisted? And I chose enlisted. I don't often meet other people who chose to go enlisted when they could have gone in as an officer. And you were already done with college. I was still in high school at the time. Okay. So when I was going through. So that's pretty interesting to me that you were just like, you know what? This is going to be a long process. It's like a lot of variables. This is quick. Let's just go. That's interesting. And so what was boot camp like for you?
So boot camp for me, I mean, I had studied psychology, so I really felt like I was in one of the like Stanford prison experiments that we had learned about in psychology 101. Like, I was like fascinated. I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is the authority. And we're all like freaking out together because they're making us freak out and be stressed out. So for me, it was just annoying, to be completely honest. Like, I had some expectations, like, you know, the three of me and my girlfriends, we all surf. We're like, oh, we'll be in the ocean. We'll do rescues. We'll like learn all this, you know, navigation kind of thing. And no, it was just regular boot camp. It was, you know, doing push-ups in the mud and just getting yelled at for doing stupid things. So we got, I think we all put on our application that like, once we enlisted, we would like to, you know, maybe apply to officer candidate school after we, you know, put in our time. And so I think we got ignored a little bit because it's like, okay, like they somewhat have their shit together a little bit. They might be in charge of us one day. So I wouldn't say we had it super easy. We got the brunt of, you know, the stress and getting screamed at. I mean, not a lot of people grow up having ever been screamed at, you know, so that for me was new, to just have somebody in your face yelling. But, you know, you learn what's going on and just, you know, try to be a little bit strategic about avoiding those kinds of things. So,
okay. So wait, you said that you didn't grow up with someone screaming at you. So boot camp was, that part of boot camp was totally new. That's interesting to me because I'm the opposite of that.
Okay.
So I have to know though, what was it like for you the first time they got in your face and screamed at you? What was going through you at that moment?
I remember it like very clearly. That was 2009. So it's been over 10 years, but I remember it very clearly. That first time someone was in my face, I had a bodily reaction. Like, I almost lost everything in my stomach. It was that like, just that like bodily stress that I had never felt before, like that drastically. So it must have been like something in that fight or flight thing actually happened to me with that level of screaming. And like, I played soccer in college, like I've been yelled at by coaches, but not that like in your face, personal, like intense kind of screaming. So yeah, my body reacted to that the very first time.
I can just imagine. But having gone through a psychology program, I imagine the psychological aspects of it, you sort of got like the programming and the breaking you down to build you back up. I'm sure that you already kind of understood the process. Is just when it's actually happening, it can be kind of traumatic. I mean, I experienced that growing up, but it was still pretty traumatizing when it started happening in boot camp for me. And I was Navy. So it was still, I imagine our boot camp experience was fairly similar.
Is my point. Yeah, I think they've all kind of evened out. But getting yelled at by like a stranger and a man that you like don't know and not being able to look at them is, yeah, it's just all very, very strange. I think that's actually why I got yelled at, because I like accidentally made eye contact. You know, can't do that. Can't wear a ponytail either. That's what I learned very quickly too.
Wow, you couldn't wear a ponytail?
No, it was a bun. Like, you had to have the bun, but, you know, I didn't watch the movies about boot camp girl. You know, like, I feel like maybe people in that culture or men or something grew up watching the war movies and seeing that. And I had no idea. So
Hair regulations, that got me in boot camp too. I mean, I've told the story a million times, but shout out to my boot camp sisters that saved me from getting my head shaved.
Oh my gosh.
Due to hair regulations and my recruiter not having them accurate for boot camp. So I feel you on that. What was the most challenging part of boot camp? Was it getting accustomed to the yelling and all of that, or was it, you know, the other aspects, like I imagine the classwork wasn't very difficult for you, or the physical preparedness since you surfed and all of that. So what was the most difficult part?
Most difficult part? I think the worst thing was, like, they came and they trashed our room. You know, the company commanders, they just threw your stuff everywhere. And they're like, you have 5 minutes to clean this all up. And I'm looking around, I'm like, this is going to take a lot longer than 5 minutes. Like, do you really mean 5 minutes? Or, like, do you want us to, like, kind of put it away and then go outside? Like, my thing was just, like, I was trying to make sense of something that, like, they purposely didn't want to make sense. And so it was like, okay, well, like, should we actually fold everything and, like, clean everything up and then go outside? Or is that going to be wrong? Or should we just, like, throw stuff in our bunks and go outside? But that's going to be wrong. And you're like, we're going to be wrong no matter what we do. Like,
right.
So, once I understood that, I think I kind of fell into place. I'm like, well, this is going to be wrong, so let me just choose an option. But I think initially just being like, wait, like, what do they want me to do to be right? And, like, you're not going to be right. So that was the tough part.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's super hard. Did you make any good friends while you were in boot camp? Were your friends with you in your same boot camp company?
They were. We all ended up in the same company, which was nice because we could at least, like, look at each other and just be like, oh my God, like, just with a look, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was really comforting to have. Yes, like, I think because of social media, you know, being back in the day, we had a Facebook group with everybody in our boot camp class. Wow. Yeah. So yeah, I published my book and, you know, a couple of my old shipmates reached out and said they loved it and they loved the boot camp chapter. So yeah, it's pretty amazing how, not close contact, but, you know, if you're on Instagram, you can, like, see how most of the women got out. So we've all, you know, I think we touched base during that transition too, just to, like, check in and see how it was going with everybody. So it's definitely a cool,
good awesome
community to have. Yeah.
What was the size? Was it big? I imagine it would be kind of fairly small.
It's small. Yeah. The Coast Guard's small. I think there's, like, more NYPD officers than Coast Guard members. So it's a small service. I want to say we had maybe 70 people total and, like, 15 or 20 women, maybe 15.
15. Wow.
Yeah.
Was it integrated companies? Were there, you know, guys in with your company as well?
Yeah, they were integrated. Yes. And yeah, we're all in the same Facebook group. I ended up being stationed at a unit with one of the guys, like, a few years later. So it's such a small service. You're going to run into people if you stay in long enough.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was also in an integrated company, but for me, when they were doing that, it was super new. I think I was in the third one. So it was a new experience, but I didn't know anything different until afterwards when I met other people who had gone through just before me when I was in A school, because I went to A school on the other side of the recruit training command in Naval Hospital, Great Lakes. And when I met them, they would be like, no, we had a brother company. We didn't have an integrated company. And I think that was going on when I was actually in boot camp too, but I just was so preoccupied with everything I had going on that I didn't really realize it. So
that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I also wonder too, if sometimes it felt a little bit easier in boot camp being a woman because our three company commanders were men. So they actually weren't allowed to come into the bathroom and yell at you. So there was this level of separation that I think you know, the men in boot camp didn't quite get because we didn't have a female in charge of us. So yeah, that's, I hadn't thought about that.
Oh, we did. We had a female and a male.
Okay.
And it was, she was really, you could tell, I could sense anyway, that she was really a decent person. But she was really good at her job. Yeah. They picked well for her in that role. So tell me, what was it like after boot camp? How did you transition? Did you go to like an A school, or how did you transition to your next command?
So this is a tough one for Coasties. So unless you get guaranteed A school to something that's in very high demand, like, you know, mechanic, boat driver, you go to a unit, like just any unit. You could be on a ship. I was at a small boat station. And you do the grunt work. It's supposed to be 6 months to a year. And then you go to your A school. Is that the Navy?
Yeah, for the Navy, like, it's the temporary personnel unit. And so they go and do like sort of grunt work, like you were saying. They just do sort of odd jobs or go where they're needed until a school opens up for them or they get assigned.
Okay. Yeah, very similar. So mine was a small boat station way out in Long Island, in Montauk. I went from California to like the opposite end of the country. So it's supposed to be 6 months to a year, but I don't know if it was because of like budget cuts or whatever, but I wanted to be an intel specialist. And that waiting period ended up being 3 years. So I was at a small boat station. I just got trained in everything but like driving the boat. Like I was on the boarding team, I was on the boat crew. I started my master's degree using tuition assistance, but it was a struggle. There were two rates, the intel specialist and the maritime like science technician. Those are my two friends were waiting for that one, and I was waiting for the intel specialist. And both of those waits were just, we were all three of us were just stuck at our units for 3 years trying to figure out like, is our contract going to end before we go to A school? So that was a tough experience.
I can just imagine. And you guys all went to different duty stations then?
We did. Yeah. I mean, the funny story is the two girls, they were twins and their names both started with A. So they're the same initials. So they actually only had one billet for them. So they had to scramble. The Coast Guard had to scramble when they graduated boot camp and like make up a second billet for the second person who was graduating.
Oh my gosh. How stressful.
Yeah.
I can just imagine which one of them was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Who gets the actual billet?
Oh my goodness. So how did you enjoy your duty station?
That duty station was the most toxic thing I've ever experienced in my life. It was an isolated station, so there were no officers. Our like kind of more headquarters unit was across the sound, so it was, you know, a boat ride away. It was small. It was probably about 25 people, and just walking into it, the chief got relieved a few weeks after I arrived for like just not good behavior and not like good safety protocol. So that, you know, anytime like your leadership gets relieved, like the unit probably was already in disarray, and then it's in even more disarray because now there's this vacancy of like instruction. So yeah, a lot of just like sexism, racism, like every day, just comments that you have to figure out how you're going to get through the day to like, I could just go back to my bunk and just like work on my schoolwork.
Oh my God. So you go from beautiful California, San Diego, yeah, all the way to New York, Long yeah. Island, and you're on this tiny little duty station. You get there and it's in havoc the minute you walk in the door, and it's poor leadership, which we discuss a lot because it comes up a lot on this show, actually. Actually, good leadership comes up a lot too, because it's equally as important to point that out, right? Mm-hmm. But when you hear about this, it automatically makes me think of like Fort Hood.
Okay, yeah.
Everything that happens there, because when you, it's a perfect example of how the command can go so far downhill when the leadership is not at its best, for whatever reason. And so you had to witness, and I'm sure experience, a lot of of really toxic behaviors. And it's amazing because it's all like, it could go either way. With 25 people, it could be heaven or it could be hell, you know?
Right.
It could be a big, happy family or a nightmare.
Yeah. And I think the problem is, so there'd be pockets of good people, but you could never get rid of the bad because there was never like a clean slate. It was never like, oh, this 4 years is up, we get a brand new team. There's always the lingering toxic people that, oh, they still have two more years. So even if you got, you know, a little bit of good leadership, there's just this like lingering and ever present, just nastiness. Yeah. I was sexually harassed. And when I left to school in my next unit, and I got a call from the investigative services, and that person that was harassing me had actually like assaulted the next person that took my place at the unit. So it was like that kind of just really bad place to be.
I'm just getting chills. It's so horrible. Mm-hmm. Like, because clearly the perpetrator was escalating.
Right.
So how did this happen? Did you just go to work one day and this person just started targeting you?
It was, yeah, like you said, it's kind of slow. It was also like, you know, people have been texting. So it would be, he would text about, you know, the shift. So it'd be a text like, you have the night shift, da da. And then, you know, the next day it'd be a text about, you know, something about my body or something. You know, it was just like very much, there's a line, and just kind of like jumping across it a little bit, testing the line, how I'd react. And yeah, and like letting me, you know, maybe go do a workout and then like, you know, straight up asking for a favor. And it was like, whoa, no. Like, this is.
Do you mean like a sexual favor? Wait, what, was this person like your superior?
Yeah, he was a couple of ranks above me. And so it was, the weekends were the worst because the command wasn't in the office. So you were working and this person was in charge of, you know, 10 to 12 people. Yeah, I write about it. I guess it's harder to talk about it because it's just like such an ugly thing to have to deal with. And I was, you know, I'm like 22 years old. I have no real world experience. I was in college the last couple of years, you know? So, and just the rank system too. Like, if that's one thing, if it's in your office, you can quit, you can move teams, you can go to HR, but yeah, like there's no HR when you're in an isolated unit, you know, out in Montauk, New York. So yeah, that was stressful.
I'm stuck on, so yeah, you can go work out. So when I used to work out like religiously at lunchtime when I was stationed at Great Lakes, when I was in the pharmacy, it was a big part of our department culture. Was our commander ran marathons and everybody ran in that department. Wow. It was like a culture of runners. And I wasn't a big runner, but I ran and I worked out a lot. And we would always get this privilege. I felt it was a privilege to have an hour and a half lunch if you worked out. So we all worked out because we wanted to have an hour and a half lunch, right? So I'm thinking in my mind, as it relates to your story, you know, hey, I like to go work out. And then sure, you can go work out. And then like later, you said a favor. So this person then propositioned you like, hey, I let you go work out, so now you owe me like whatever gross thing.
Yeah, it was just one of these things that it was like a weekend, a Sunday. And, you know, you asked to go because our base is so small. So if you want to do anything like a run or get off base, like you have to ask because, okay, if there's a phone call or a rescue, they need to know where you are. So it was coming back from that. And then, yeah, just being like, I'm like, oh, I'm about to go. Like, let me just go get ready. I'll get back on watch. And it was just, I was just me and him there. And luckily there's other idiots at the unit. It was like football Sunday. They come charging in and just unknowingly disrupt everything. And I was like, oh my God, thank God. They just like,
oh my goodness,
charged into the door. Yeah, it was like a movie scene where, and I just left. So
it sounds like a nightmare, actually. Yeah. And then to think that that guy actually ended up assaulting someone later, like, that's, it's just so frightening.
It's the thing, he actually had a history of it in his record, or so, like, they started calling people, and wherever he was, there was some women that were like, oh yeah, by the way. Yeah. So I'm glad like the Coast Guard started taking that stuff seriously, but it's sad that it took this long in his career for people to finally do something about his behavior. So
it's gross, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's really unfortunate on the military in general and every single branch, you know, shame on them for how mm-hmm. long it's taken them to take action. And still everything with Vanessa Guillen and the reforms, you know, even the Brandon Act, like all of these things that are happening now, and we're still working so hard to get more reforms and to get more changes done, that it's 2020, mm-hmm. 2021, going into 2022. And finally, we're starting to see a little bit of forward motion, right?
Yeah. So
these last, you know, 2 years have been instrumental in pushing things forward. But look what you had to go through. That's not that long ago.
No, that's, 2009. I mean, it makes me mad because it's not even just the women. Like, the guys knew this guy, you know, was an idiot and had a power issue. And, you know, it disrupted it for more than just the women at the unit. So, mm-hmm. The culture problem is just so huge.
I agree with you. I actually was just thinking about when you said about the texting mm-hmm. and how, you know, it would be like maybe work related 1 minute, but then the next text might be something inappropriate. We didn't have texts serving. Okay. It was the mid-90s. We didn't have text or anything like that or social media. Thank God. We did have something called CHCS. You old schoolers will know what I'm talking about, but it was sort of like instant messaging in the command. But your story reminds me of another story from this podcast. My friend Jana, who actually served with me at Great Lakes, tells a story on her episode, I think the last season of the show. So season 6, I think. And I'm losing track of all the seasons now. And she was talking about her duty station in Hawaii, where she was an EMT, and the guy she was working with started harassing her. And it started off like, you know, they were friendly, they were cool. Then they got, you know, closer because they worked all together. So they were like, became kind of good friends. And then the conversation started shifting, crossing a boundary of into inappropriate, but it was like gradual. So it's mm-hmm. like grooming you into being sexually harassed. Right. Yeah. And I think that happens, like, it's something we should talk about, you know, as women who served and amongst women who are still in active duty, about how these things happen to us, because sometimes it happens so gradually that we don't even realize. All of a sudden we're like, whoa, this person who was my friend is now really becoming someone who is uncomfortable to be around.
Right.
And it's a hard position to be in, because whether it's your superior or it's your coworker, your base is a lot like a high school. It's a small, you know, no matter what base you're on, right? It's a small place. Rumors spread, you know, everybody knows everybody, and it's a very difficult position to navigate, you know, without becoming that girl or becoming ostracized because you stood up for yourself or you reported. Or there's so many things that can happen when you just try to do the right thing for yourself, or you're the people who are seeing, like you said, uncomfortable mm-hmm. for the other guys or the other girls who are witnessing that. And now they are in an awkward and uncomfortable position as well, because now, you know, if you stay quiet, you're kind of an accomplice to it, right? But if you right. say something, then what?
You're disrupting, you know, the whole, quote unquote, disrupting the whole unit, which is already disrupted because of this behavior that's going on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think your point about the slowness to it, and especially an isolated station, especially somewhere that's toxic, like, you're constantly looking for who you can trust. So if somebody's putting out the jokes or, like, you know, trying to indicate that they're a trustworthy person, and then you get this, like, you know, slow movement and then something shocking, you're like, whoa, 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 wait, this is not what I thought it was. And in this person's case, it's not like a mistaken flirtation. Like, this guy had a wife, she was pregnant. Like, this was not like, you know, a misinterpretation of signals. Like, this is just like toxic. So
I'm so sad that you had to deal with that. How did you manage? Like, cause you said you could have just been happier back in your barracks, like doing your schoolwork. Mm-hmm. So how did you manage to cope day to day with that happening?
Yeah. I mean, my coping mechanism at the time was like running, surfing. I would run in the morning before the day started. Looking back, I was like, how was I up at 5 a.m. like running like 5-10 miles? I just like exhausted myself before the day and then like numbed myself with exercise. And then at the end of the day, or, you know, during watch, if I had a chance, I would just focus on my schoolwork. And that was kind of my escape.
Schoolwork saved you. Yeah. And exercise. I mean, there are a lot more negative ways that the energy could have, that negative toxic energy could have been channeled.
For sure. Yeah. I'm definitely paying for it though. Like go to the VA for my back now, like my hips are messed up. So like there is this, like, you know, it's still, even if I wasn't hitting the bottle, like it was still a damaging way to cope with it. So.
Wow. That is so interesting that you would say. I definitely can see your point. Because when you said I was running like 10 miles every morning, I thought to myself, holy crap, that's like a lot. Like, that's a lot. So to hear you say now my body is paying for it, and it wasn't a positive way, as positive, maybe it wasn't as negative as, you know, other ways, but still, I can definitely understand that. And it just speaks to how, when these things happen to us, we do have to channel that in some way. And whatever we do, if it's excessive, it can ultimately be damaging. And we should never, and the thing is, we should never, that's a result of your military service. You should never have had to experience that or to be dealing with these health related issues as a result of it. So how did you get off of that base?
Oh my gosh. I finally got my security clearance that went through. I got my orders to A school. So I finally went to the Intel school. It was full of people that had all been at their units for 2 or 3 years. So we all had a pretty similar mindset, and, you know, we weren't the sharpest bunch after you've been out of boot camp and everything for 2 or 3 years. You're kind of like, well, like, I don't feel like I owe you my shiniest boots right now. we all, you know, I think, and a lot of us actually too had also been to college and chose to enlist. So I think because of the economic issues at that time, that we were kind of like this first wave of people just being like, yeah, let's enlist and, you know, get started on our careers at least. So it was a great class. Like, that was where finally people were cool. Things made sense. You know, we all, like, no problems there with any harassment. Like, I feel like we're all just like really stoked to be moving on and moving out of wherever we had been for a couple of years.
Oh, that sounds awesome. It must've been such a relief for you, and to be like learning something new and pursuing the goal that you set for yourself. That must've felt really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just, I honestly don't even remember the coursework or anything, but I just remember, I think I just finally started to like actually relax slightly. So yeah, it was a good time.
Well, fortunately, you know, your first experience didn't completely sour you on the military, and you were able to go to another place and have a better experience. And so what was it like for you to finally get out in the field and start doing the work?
It was great. Yeah. Like, A school was a good experience. And then my next unit was just fabulous. It was a Joint Interagency Task Force South in Key West. So it was every military branch. Yeah. Counter drug work. So, you know, like, there's some excitement. There's some like Groundhog's Day aspect to it where it's always the same, you know, drug loads coming. But it was just like the Joint Task Force made things just nice, because that like strict hierarchy went away, because, you know, you forgot somebody's rank, or there's just this aspect of everyone being like, oh wait, what's an O2 in the Air Force? You know, it's like,
I'm like that now, I feel like. Like, oh, I have to remember ranks and rates for every branch, and I mean, it can be a lot.
Yeah. So it's just nice. And I think too, like, there's something cool, like the whole place was covered. So even if you were outside on the compound, there was something over you. So you really were never, like, you know, stressfully saluting anybody because everybody was uncovered. So, like, there's something too just about the space. There are a bunch of civilians working down there, which, you know, puts a little bit of a check on some people's egos as well. So I enjoyed it. That was hard doing night shifts, and Key West is also really isolating, but I at least enjoyed going to work.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, we spend most of our time at work.
Oh yeah, especially the military. Yeah.
Right. So you want to, you got duty, all of that. So you want to be able to have, I mean, I always say if you land at a really good duty station, that could change the whole trajectory of your career. Right. Because there's so many people that are like, I went and I've interviewed a good handful of them that said, I landed at this base. This happened to me. This was horrifying. It soured me on the military. I got out as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and they would have been great career people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was my contract. I had to extend because I went to A school, so I owed them more time. But yeah, I'm so glad to end on a good one after this unit, after being there a couple of years. The fear, though, was there. The fear that, you know, if I had stayed for another four, there was that fear of like, well, what if the next unit is like that first one? And I would be signed in to this contract. So yeah, I made it to a good one, but I couldn't get myself to continue afterwards.
So it did happen to you too. I'm the same. Mm-hmm. I was like, I mean, I knew going in that I was going to do my 5 years in my reserve time and then get out. I knew that was going to be what it was. I couldn't see myself doing more than 8 years. I was 17 when I enlisted. I did a delayed enlistment till after I graduated high school. So at 17, I was like, oh my God, I do not want to be old when I get out of the military. Like, I want to, you know, live life not belonging to the government, like not as property of the United States government. You know, I don't want to be 30, which I thought was old at 17, by the way. And like, you know, in the military, I want to have my freedoms that I'm going in to protect. I want to have them and experience them. And so while I'm still young, little did I know I would still be young.
Yeah, when you're looking back.
And looking back, I was like, maybe I should have gone ROTC. I don't know. I just did an interview with Pat Williams from MOAA, a wonderful partnership that I have. They're the Military Officers Association. And they do a lot of philanthropy and work out here for veterans, which I love. Everybody knows I love that. And she was talking about her career. And when I was listening to her 35-year career, at the end of that conversation, I was like, well, damn, maybe I misjudged this. Like, you know, like, well, maybe maybe I should have made some different choices. But, you know, everything happens as it's supposed to. And it's always so amazing to hear someone have such a long and amazing career when I often hear the opposite and experienced, like, I saw some things, I witnessed some things that made me really uncomfortable. I experienced some things that made me really like my choice to get out at five, like, can't come fast enough. It was like, you see those old prison movies where they're like, on the wall. Oh, yeah. That was me from day one of boot camp. I was like, how many?
Oh, wow.
Oh, 5 years.
Even
though I had a great time, I had more fun than anyone should ever have while serving in the military, to be honest with you. Okay. It almost caught up with me a few times, I will admit, but I did have a really great time until the day I didn't. And then I had to make some changes
okay.
in order to remain free, as even the free of being in the military and not in the brig, to be
put
it bluntly. But you can hear that story because I am working on a book project myself, and I'm going to share a little bit of that story because I never really go into it here. So tell me, I want to talk about your book and I want to talk about all these things, but before I get there, I want to find out what your transition out of the military was like.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because you say, yeah, like sometimes the unit can really change your trajectory. So being at this joint task force, I was in contact with people in all the three-letter agencies of the U.S. government. So I had, you know, FBI colleagues, DEA colleagues, NSA colleagues. And so that changed my trajectory. So I ended up applying to some government work and going in that direction. I eventually started at the CIA, you know, using my intel stuff. So that was super cool. But the actual transition was tough. So I always say that, you know, I had a security clearance. I had finished my master's degree. My sister lived outside of DC and I knew there were jobs there. So I took the leap. And even with all that stuff, I struggled to get that first job. Like it took over 6 months. I was really hard on myself. I was, you know, you start to wonder if you're ever going to find a job, if this was all just like a big mistake. You know, am I ever going to have my own apartment and like move on? So even with, you know, the credentials and, you know, family support and everything, it was really hard. It was really hard. So it gave me a lot of compassion for the veteran transition experience, because if I had it that hard and I had all that on my resume and I had family support, I mean, it's hard to imagine what it's like, you know, for a lot of people that don't have all of that and also have, you know, maybe more trauma and more struggles that they're dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, I knew people who couldn't go home, like, and they were med boarded out of the military perhaps, and they'd had nowhere to really go, you know, and yeah. This is how we see veterans end up on the streets. Couple that with maybe some harassment or assault that they experienced while serving, and then they're put out of the military because maybe they attempted suicide and they have no home. They were escaping a bad situation to go by going into the military. All of these factors come into play. And then that's how you can see how easily it can happen, where if you don't have that support, you can end up in the streets. And, you know, I almost ended up in the streets. You know, 3 years after I was out of the military, I was 2 weeks from being homeless.
Wow.
And it just so happened that I got a job that paid me and enough time that I would have enough money to get down for an apartment. And a kind woman, God rest her soul, Eileen Francis, who I was leaving a marriage, I was divorcing, which was all part of this. And mm-hmm. She was 5 times divorced. She owned properties around Chicago. And she let me and a friend of mine who, you know, became my roommate because I couldn't afford the rent on my own. She's a veteran friend of mine, actually. She let us move in and didn't charge us rent for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And without that, I had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
You know, and I had no money. He left me with nothing.
Wow.
So it was a tough moment, you know, and it's actually what led me down the path to where I am now.
Okay.
So I imagine you being in that tough moment and your difficult transition has led you down the path to where you are now, to being a successful writer, to doing philanthropic work with other veterans, you know, but it's a very tough moment to be in. How did you manage those emotions?
Yeah, it was a tough time, I guess, from being in such, you know, that first terrible environment, like just you learn to put on that tough face and keep going to your job interviews and cry when you get home and, you know, like,
yeah.
Just push through it. I mean, I didn't really start with any of the veterans programs until a little bit later. And then once I found Team Red, White, and Blue, which does like fitness events around some of the bigger cities, then I started to feel a little bit of support just being around some other veterans who had already gone, you know, they moved to DC and already were a few steps ahead of me. And I think that really helped, just having that first network of other veterans who were like, you're going to get a job. Like, here's some more contact information. Here's like a friend of a friend who, you know, owns a contracting company. So yeah, I think man, just trying to stay positive, knowing that leaving the military, I was betting on myself and I needed to just keep that up.
Mm, I feel that. I feel that too. When I left, I couldn't get a job in my field. I couldn't get a job doing pharmacist work. What we did in the pharmacy, but we were taxed, was the same thing the pharmacist did exactly in the military. But coming out without the degree from a university, I couldn't do my job that I've been doing for the last 3 years, which I am still on my soapbox about, by the way, because I really feel like if you are trained by the government, that should account for something. Let me take a national certification. I'll pass a test. Let me just pass a test and be able to move into my job. But I digress. That's my soapbox, by the way. I digress. It makes me so mad because it changed the course of my life. Not that I'm complaining, but it would have been really different if I could have just left at 25 years old and then been a pharmacist.
Right. Some sort of security. And
a drastically easier transition. Mm-hmm. So I love that you said that after a while, you started interacting with veterans. Like, that's what always happens. I think that helps. We help each other. And that's so important. As soon as I got on my feet, I started helping other veterans. I'd come across, because social media was around by then. So I started reaching out to veterans that way. And I didn't know that that's what I needed until I started doing it. So when you got involved with this organization and you started connecting with other veterans, what was the biggest takeaway of that for you?
I mean, just being around people who were a few years ahead of me and just seeing that, like, okay, I'm going to be fine. Like, this might take a while. It could take 8 months to get a job. It could take a year. But just, it will happen, was the message I got from being with them. You know, your family, for me, like, my family is not military family, so they were as helpful as they could be, but they didn't know. And so hearing it from people who had been through it, that was what I needed at that time.
That's amazing. So tell me, you worked for the CIA. Was that the first job that you got after?
It's not. I first did a contracting gig, which did not make me enough to pay rent in DC, but it was you just had to take, right? My mentality was, I'm going to take the first job I can get at this point and just wait for other stuff to come through. And then the State Department job came through, and then I eventually worked for the CIA after that. So
what was it like working for the State Department?
I mean, it was similar to, I think a lot of those organizations are pretty similar. You have like a good deal of autonomy and trust, you know, compared to the military where you're being micromanaged. So it was cool. It was kind of like I got to just be my nerdy self and research, you know, foreign affairs issues and, you know, write things up for my supervisors. So yeah, both those organizations are really interesting ones to work for.
And I imagine the CIA must have been pretty fun. Did you have any cool missions that you can talk about? A little bit.
I know. It's funny. Yeah, my book is like, let me put some CIA stuff in here so people like don't feel cheated. Just talking about the
so interesting.
CIA stories. I know the culture. I think the important thing for me to me is like the culture is. Maybe just coming from the military, it was very creative, and it was like we had a brainstorm session and, you know, trying to brainstorm, you know, what would happen during an event. And the first rule of brainstorming was that nobody's ideas get thrown out or discounted until we're done brainstorming, because we want everything on the board, even if it's the most ridiculous thing. Like, putting that out there might lead us closer to like an actual thing. So it's just like a super smart organization and very agile. And I left because I couldn't handle DC anymore, but I really enjoyed the job and the people and the adventure.
Wow. Did you get to go many places?
I did. We don't name countries, but yeah, I was in like the Latin American region, and yeah, I got to got to travel and just see things from a different side. I was working also on their counter-narcotics mission, which is what I did in the Coast Guard. So seeing it from their perspective and like their level of influence was, you know, it's kind of just taking me one more step to have this like really bird's eye view of, you know, what the U.S. was doing against like narcotics trafficking. So
it's amazing. So yeah. Really impressive. Okay, so two questions about the CIA, and then we're going to move on. I can't really give up too much information, which is equally cool. So what was your biggest challenge working for that agency?
Oh, biggest challenge. I mean, I think initially I got hired into the wrong position for my personality. So I was in one directorate that was like a little more of like the extroverted directorate. I went to like one of our trainings where we had to meet people and, you know, try to schmooze them. And like, that was not what I wanted to do at all.
Right on.
So the biggest challenge was finding my place in the organization. But once I found it, I ended up in the directorate of analysis, and like the culture fit was great. The training, everyone was very supportive. Whereas the director of operations is a little bit more military and hierarchical, where the director of analysis is much more, I don't know, your instructors want you to feel confident about yourself and your analysis. So I felt like that was great for like where I was and what I needed.
Excellent. And so would you say that was the greatest takeaway from that experience, was moving into a better directorate? Or what would you say is your greatest takeaway from your experience with the CIA?
I think, they allowed for so much movement just so you could find your fit. And so I think just taking that into your career and being like, okay, like if this is not my fit, I don't have to force it. Like, I can try something else and then come back if that something else isn't working. So I think the amount of flexibility they allowed people, because it was in their best interest to have people happy, because they don't want people selling their secrets. So, you know, they want you to be in the job that you love and with the culture that fits you. So I think taking that lesson into your own career is also so important. Like, do something where it's a good fit.
You know, and in my master's program, I was so interested in corporate culture. And so I was always writing these papers and doing these studies and doing research on corporate culture, right? And I found back in the day, because this is a while ago, that most organizations don't hire the right fit for the job, which leads to loss of profit, because people then just come to work to collect a check because they're in the wrong job or with the wrong organization. It's somehow not a fit. But if you take the time, like you're saying, to find, and this goes for like, if you're looking for a job too, to find a position that works for you, I always tell people to remember that you are interviewing them too, because you want to see if you're going to be a fit, if you're going to work for that company as well. So to come from a position of power instead of like, oh, I really just need this job. Yeah, I understand. You just need a job.
Right.
But you will end up quitting that job or getting fired from that job or just being miserable in the job. And like we said earlier, we spend most of our time working. So it's just better to find a place where you can be happy and where you'll fit. And then you do a better job, so the organization's happy and you're happier. So I love that you said that. This is amazing. So tell me now, how did you come up with the idea about your book?
My book started out as a 5-minute comedy set.
That's awesome.
I took a course with the Armed Service Arts Partnership, which is a nonprofit that I had told you about. And I went through their comedy boot camp class, which is like 6 weeks, one day a week. And they help you put together a 5-minute comedy set. And at the end, you do a graduation show. So we did our graduation show at like DC Improv, like very legit, big crowd, everything.
Really cool.
Yeah, I just realized there were more to the jokes that I wanted to talk about. And so I started writing December 2019 and just started figuring out the process as I went. So how do I get an editor? How do I find a publisher? But yeah, it started out as that core 5-minute set of punchlines.
That's amazing. And so your book is super, super cute. It can be found on Amazon, which is where I'm getting it, or my Kindle. And so it's called Fairly Smooth Operator, My Life Occasionally at the Tip of the Spear. What made you come up with that title?
I see it as satire. So there's a lot of these romance and like special ops novels called Smooth Operator. And I just was like, you know what? I'm a fairly smooth operator. And then I also, the tip of the spear, I thought got really overused as a phrase in the military. Like, oh, you're at the tip of the spear. And it's like, no, you're not. You're writing analysis. You're at the other end of the spear. Like, get out of here. So, I just put it together just as like a big, like, all right, like, let's talk about what the military was really like and stop putting on this front that we're all a bunch of like hero and like special ops people.
So. That was so funny. So I'm really excited to read it, and I hope everybody reads it. What can we expect when we start reading this book? I know it's short stories, so tell me more.
So you can expect it's short stories. It's a mix of like funny and then serious. So I do get into like the sexual assault and harassment. I do talk about like the military suicide, you know, but it's mixed in with some lighter stories. So you're not going to like, you know, it's not going to be a bunch of heaviness like throughout the whole book. So it kind of like brings you down, lifts you up. I'm also like, I like stuff to move quickly. Like, I don't like to read about, like, you're not going to know exactly what type of boat I was on with like all the, like,
you know, all the details.
Details. Like, you're going to be like, it was about, here's the part that I really want you to know. So I kind of wrote it how I like to read it. But yeah, like short stories that go in mostly chronological order. Yeah.
Outstanding. So, and now you teach comedy.
Yeah. So
let's talk about that.
Yes.
So how did you get into that? Was that part of from this?
That was through the Armed Service Arts Partnership. So they do a great job of letting people take the lead. Once you've taken the class, you can become a mentor. After you mentor a couple of classes, you can be a teacher in training. And then once you do that, then you're the instructor and you're teaching veterans, your fellow veterans, comedy. And we have, it's based in like DC and Virginia Beach. And then I just moved out here to San Diego a couple of years ago. And so we just started our San Diego branch of the Armed Service Arts Partnership. And then we also have virtual classes. So with the pandemic, suddenly we went from only teaching in DC or wherever we had instructors to hitting, we've got like veterans logging on from the Midwest, from the Pacific Northwest. And then we do a Zoom show at the end where they can invite all their friends, family, and colleagues to watch their set.
Oh, that is so awesome.
It's so great. Yeah, you should definitely, if you ever have time, you should sign up. It sounds like you've got great stories.
I probably could do with a comedy class. I am not funny. I mean, I will say that I have known to be funny from time to time, but I'm typically the straight person in the comedy duo. Okay. So maybe taking a class would help me. I don't know.
We make sure everybody has like a funny 5 minutes. That's like our guarantee. And as an instructor, a lot of times, like we all talk, we start the class and we're like, oh no, I don't know how this is going to go. And then by week 4 or 5, we're like, everybody's hilarious. This is great.
So. Wonderful.
It's a great course.
I hope I will find the time for that. It seems like a lot of fun. And if anyone listening, if you want to find the time to do this, then I will, as you know, drop links to this program, to Carolyn's book, and her website as well in the description of this episode. If you're not sure where that is, it is where you read what the episode is about. I always write something nice about what we talk about for you to determine if you're going to listen to the episode or not. So if you keep scrolling, you will find these links to my social media and how you can donate to this episode and anything I'm supporting at the time, as I am on the board of directors for Hope for Veterans. You can find out how to donate to Hope for Veterans if you want, and any of the other not-for-profits that I work with throughout the year. So it's all there in the description box of the episode. And I would take your class, Carolyn. Awesome. I think that would be a lot of fun. And so, okay, well, I'm going to respect your time. I'm so glad that you came and shared your story with me. I just have one more question for you before we wrap it up. If you don't mind, I would love to know what advice you have for our veteran sisters coming up behind you.
I think my advice for our veteran sisters is connect with each other. Like, connect with each other, stay in contact, help each other with your careers and your network. I know my first job came from another veteran woman who connected me with somebody she knew, and that person knew somebody in my area. And so, you know, whether it's for that direct career support or just somebody to text when you're like, hey, I'm losing my shit, I don't know if I can do this, and someone picks up on the phone on the other and is like, you got this, we got this, we're going to figure it out. So I think just, you know, support each other and don't lose track of each other.
Beautiful advice. I mean, it probably saved my life having veterans in my life that I could go to for support, and then turning around and being able to help other veterans once I got my feet on the ground and was able to, you know, and that heart for serving is why most of us end up in, we think we go in for college money or this or that. But it really underneath it all is because we have this calling for something more, and supporting each other is a beautiful thing that helps us to continue to serve. So I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been so good to talk to you. You're so fun and vibrant. So this has been so great.
Oh, thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to share before we part ways today?
I don't know. Yeah, just be good to each other and have fun. Try to find the funny and the goodness and whatever you're going through.
Outstanding. I love that. And with that, we are going to wrap it up. So I want to thank you all for coming on this journey with me. It has been a crazy 2.5 years since the birth of this podcast. And I appreciate each and every one of you for listening more than you could possibly imagine. And you are why I keep doing it. And I want to thank you, Carolyn, for being my guest. It has been such a pleasure to hear your story and for you to be so candid and open and sharing everything that happened to you and everything about your difficult transition and how you finally found success and your career at the CIA and your book, and everything's just really, really been amazing to learn. And I really appreciate your time. So thank you again. And another shout out to my sponsor, Grunt Style. They really do have cool stuff. Just go to their website. I promise. If you like cute t-shirts, I love cute t-shirts with like images on the front and logos and like funny stuff on it. So it's right up my alley. But they have stuff for workouts and working out, for hunting and fishing. And they have women, men, children. And it's genuinely very cute. So I am promoting it for sure. I like them. And they are very patriotic. And they also like guns. So if you like guns, you might like their stuff. Gruntstyle.com and use code Baker. And I love you guys. I'll talk to you next time.